From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzak Berlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz, Joshua Landis, and I discuss Wednesday's attack on a satirical newspaper in Paris.
It's a very democratic ideal that we should be able to say things, print things, publish things that others don't like.
And we'll discuss Saudi Arabia's role in the ongoing fall of global oil prices.
We're expecting the Saudis to reduce their production in order to keep the prices high so Americans can get rich.
Later, my conversation with Jan Willem Rosenboom.
We have a unit being tested that produces 600 kilowatts of electricity and 1,000 gallons of drinking water per hour out of fecal sludge.
We'll talk more about market solutions to the sanitation crisis in developing countries. But first, this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Berlot. Rebecca, let's start with you and the big news out of France, the terrorist attack on a satirical magazine that killed 12 people. Islamic militants attacked the magazine for ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad. But of course, this magazine ridicules all kinds of people, political, religious leaders of all faiths. But this raises, it kind of brings back into our thinking the cyber attack on Sony from North Korea and the connection to pulling that film and then releasing the film. And so now are people going to start censoring once again what they can do, what they can say, because they're afraid they've been terrorized? What are we to think of this?
Well, we're going to see more examples of this, I'm sure, and we're going to see similar outrage as we saw with the film The Interview you mentioned there, which is an interesting comparison because, of course, in that film, Kim Jong-un is attacked. He in North Korea is considered a deity. And so this situation, if it turns out that it is because of the cartoons, and that's what we suspect at this point, is about depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. So within Islam, that is seen very much in the negative. And we have seen examples of this going back. We think right now that this is kind of a new situation, but we've had this going on since the mid-1990s, more famously in Europe here in the past decade. In 2004, Theo van Gogh did a video that led to his death. In 2005, a Danish newspaper was also targeted because of some of the cartoons that they published. So this has kind of been an ongoing back and forth. But I think where it really gets to people is this idea of freedom of speech. We may not like what these cartoons are depicting, and some of them are pretty offensive. But the idea that it cannot have that freedom of expression, that's a very democratic ideal, that we should be able to say things, print things, publish things that others don't like, and that should be respected in some form.
Well, to be fair, of course, we can't compare the death of 12 people here to a cyber attack and some of these other threats. But nonetheless, it raises these larger issues of, is this sort of attack, you know, serving the purpose of these extremists? Is it going to have the effect that they want, which is that people will stop saying what they think and making fun of stuff for entertainment or other purposes?
Well, they may think twice. I think that is the issue. But of course, it is the Muslims throughout the rest of the world that are not extremists that are now being blamed, and we are seeing a backlash here, which is also very unfortunate. And yes, of course, we can't compare the death of the 12 people here to the North Korean case.
All right. So, Joshua, off to Saudi Arabia. Let's talk about oil prices. I know we ended the year talking about oil prices, and we can't stop talking about it because they continue to drop. Saudi Arabia has reportedly forced its OPEC members to continue production in order to keep prices low. The thinking is that their short-term strategy of trying to force out their competition because it becomes too expensive for others to produce oil with oil prices that low, for their long-term gain, they're going to try to regain market share. They've got the ability to do this, $750 billion of reserves and currency in Saudi Arabia. So this raises lots and lots of issues about, you know, where we're headed with oil, how Saudi Arabia is affecting not only this issue but other relations throughout the East, and that longer-term relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. What do you make of all of this?
Well, first I would say it's really not the Saudis who are doing this to America. It's the Americans who've done this to the world through fracking. It is this new technological innovation that's allowed America to become the major producer of oil in the world. And we've flooded the market. And now we're expecting the Saudis to reduce their production in order to keep the prices high so Americans can get rich.
So that's the idea, though, is that they're not going to reduce their supply.
They're not. They're saying we're just going to carry on.
Because there's more supply coming from the United States.
We can screw you, in a sense, is what they're saying is you cost a lot to produce oil. We'll just keep it. Let the oil prices fall, and you'll go bankrupt. And this will be like the 1980s with the savings and loan crisis all over again. It hopefully will not be because our economies are more diversified in Oklahoma, Texas, and even in Dakotas. Now, this comes on top of a lot of insecurity because King Abdullah is 90 years old, born 1924, and he is in the hospital with pneumonia, may never get out of the sick bed. And that raises the question of who's going to take his place. There are still quite a few brothers of the original founder of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz, who are in line for succession. The two next crown princes are Salman bin Abdulaziz, and the deputy crown prince is a fellow named Muqrin. Now, Salman is 80 years old, 10 years younger, but many people believe that he is not well himself. So this has raised a lot of questions, and the United States is anxious because we don't have many friends left in the Middle East that we can really count on, and we've been counting on the Saudis. And so this, on top of the Arab Spring, our struggles with Iran means another big question mark in the Middle East, and we need stability in the Gulf.
Well, and that's all we need is another big question mark in the Middle East, that relationship, that long-term relationship that's now in question. All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here, as always. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments online at kgou.org or on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzek Werlot, at Joshua_Landis, and at Cruz226. After a short break, I'm joined by Jan Willem Rosenboom. He's a senior program officer for water, sanitation, and hygiene strategy at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we'll discuss business solutions to the sanitation crisis in the developing world. I'm Suzek Werlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Werlot. Today, I'm joined by Jan Willem Rosenboom. He spent the past few years at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation working on water issues in the developing world. Before that, he served in a similar role for the World Bank. Jan Willem Rosenboom, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Jan Willem, you work for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which I think must be a fascinating place to work. They have such incredible things they're trying to achieve. But the work that you're doing there as a senior program officer is in the area of sanitation. You're working on demand-led sanitation, urban sanitation markets. Can you tell us about your work, in particular, this demand-led sanitation activities that you're working on?
Sure. The demand-led sanitation portfolio came out of one of the problems we wanted to solve in sanitation, and that was widespread access in rural areas to sanitation services, and the realization that while we had interesting and effective ways to work at community level in a demand-led way on creating demand for sanitation, we didn't have really good ways to deliver services at scale. And to really say, if you want to make a difference in the number of people in the world that are without services, then you need to start finding ways of doing that work beyond one community, two community, or one district, but begin to think about how would something like this work at country level? How would it work at state level in India or at state level in Nigeria? And so that was a large part of my early work, my early portfolio with the foundation, only recently supplemented by my work in urban sanitation markets, which really focusing on urban sanitation and particularly linking to our efforts to come up with sanitation services that don't need connection to a sewer, that don't need a connection to a water supply, yet give the sort of service level of the toilet we're all used to, and figuring out how we can establish markets for these new technologies and new service models and business models.
I think one of the things that interests me in that just the title of your position, I mean, when we think of sanitation and promoting sanitation and access to sewers and water, clean water, whatever, we're thinking of assistance and aid and the engineering and all of the things that we need to provide to communities to do that. But in even in the title of your position, we're talking about demand-led issues and markets for these issues. It almost it's like there's a little different spin on it in that respect. I mean, you just referred to making, you know, creating markets for these things, creating products that serve a certain market. So it's should we start thinking about sanitation more as a business prospect, as, you know, something that's a kind of social entrepreneurial activity that's going on, as opposed to aid, assistance, you know, the human rights, the human welfare part of it, that it's about business?
Sure, sure. So there's really two sides to that. I guess one thing to begin with is to say aid is never going to solve the sanitation problem in globally. And it is not that's not necessary either. There will always be room for aid. There will always be room for public spending by governments, public subsidies to households. But we should never think of charitable spending and aid as the solution to the sanitation crisis. I don't think that would be a non-starter, just in terms of the amounts of money you would talk about, not just to provide access to services, but to sustain services, right? And so where the private sector comes in for us is to say, we would love to see sanitation service provision develop as almost like a utility, like the same way you have your water service and your utility that provides services. You pay your monthly bill, and they take care of providing you with clean drinking water. And one of the things we work on is literally trying to develop the business models that would help countries do that, that would get business people or entrepreneurs interested in entering the sanitation field, which is actually that's a task all in itself. I don't think there are very many people that kind of tell their mother-in-laws, you know, it is my ambition in life to empty septic tanks or to empty latrine pits. But it's something that we haven't quite figured out. And if you look at just rural sanitation and our Millennium Development Goals compared to 2000, we want 50% more people having access to sanitation services. But that's just a little building, right? That's just a little outhouse or whatever it is. What comes after? What happens when the pit is full? And even if you empty the pit, what do you do with the contents? How do you make sure it's safely disposed of? That is an area that hasn't been getting a lot of attention, whether in rural areas or where in urban slums. The whole question of fecal sludge management isn't there. And the only way I think we're going to solve that is by really making that into a business-driven series of solutions, and we are trying to look for some of these solutions and test them.
That's my guest, Jan Willem Rosenboom, who works with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as a senior program officer for water, sanitation, and hygiene. After a short break, he'll describe both short and long-term strategies for communities with high poverty and poor sanitation in the developing world. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest today is Jan Willem Rosenboom, a Senior Program Officer for Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We were just talking about rural sanitation issues and the idea of using business-driven solutions to achieve some of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. So can you tell us a little bit about maybe some of the challenges of that and whether you're focusing internally on domestic business opportunities? Because, I mean, you think about these communities you're working in are obviously poor communities. And you've written elsewhere that, you know, sanitation and poverty, there's just a cycle there, you know, that they're constantly feeding off each other in terms of poor places you find poor sanitation, and in places where you find poor sanitation, you find poverty. So there's this cycle that's perpetuated by these two. So what are the business models that you can produce in poor communities and places that are struggling, you know, because they're experiencing extreme poverty? Or are you looking at people that are going to, you know, come in, external investors, capital investors, people that will come and set up these kinds of businesses and provide these services? What is the strategy that you're using to perpetuate this?
All of the above. I mean, we are – it's very clear that, you know, we don't have the answer, and there is no such thing as the answer. And so we're trying different things in different places. To give you – I'll try to give you two examples, one of where we're kind of looking at the future, what we would like to see develop, and one where we are working right now to make things work better and demonstrate how that can be done. So the right now example is in the city of Dakar in Senegal, where we have invested in setting up a call center for the emptying of septic tanks. And that addresses the fact that households don't know where to go when they need a service, and B, the service providers don't have a way to reach the households that need a service. And there is now a central telephone number and a call center where people call. They say, I want to have my septic tank emptied. I want to have my pit emptied. And the call center bids out that job to trucks in the area, and the truck operators can bid on that particular demand, and the lowest bidder gets the job. And what has happened over the year and a half that has been in operation is that demand has gone up, so there's more households that actually make the call and bid. Their prices have gone down, because the number of jobs that individual operators do has actually gone up with the growing demand, and the amount of fecal sludge that is taken to the treatment plant has gone up as well, to the point where now the operator, the city-level operator of the treatment plant, is actually a profit-making entity, whereas before it wasn't. And they actually just hired a director from outside to help them expand this to other areas and improve to other parts of the city. So that's a great example where you can say you have a system in place. That's true. You have a utility in Dakar. There is a treatment plant in Dakar. There are private operators. And we've just intervened to help make the system work better, and it has led to improvements for everybody. And so if you look at a scoring that the Water and Sanitation Program has done. It's a World Bank-affiliated organization that studied fecal sludge management in 10 cities. Dakar comes out as a city that's doing well in terms of its regulatory environment, in terms of its policies and the services available. Yet, citywide, only 37% of all the fecal sludge that they produce is treated. So, you know, it's doing well, but it can do better, and we're helping them get there. The future project that we are thinking about is saying, imagine that some of the technologies we are developing, which are focused on better emptying of the pits that exist and decentralized treatment, and that reclaims useful products from the waste. So we stop considering waste as waste. Say you can generate electricity out of it. We have a unit being tested in Seattle actually right now that produces 600 kilowatts of electricity and 1,000 gallons of drinking water per hour out of fecal sludge that is fed into the system from 100,000 people, about 20,000 households. And once that is in full commercial production and being used, you would hope that there are entrepreneurs that are willing to invest and that we would help uncover or establish financing streams that would make it possible for these businesses to be set up to run emptying services treatment as a profitable business, and that becomes sort of the norm where, or you know, even a government can run a profitable business. And our thinking is that the moment that happens, you change the thinking around sanitation. If for the government, it's always a money sink. Yeah, you can provide services, but it costs money and it doesn't bring in any money. What you see so often is that, you know, a loan, let's say from the Asian Development Bank or from the World Bank, pays for a treatment center, pays for your infrastructure. And then the maintenance takes money and the maintenance doesn't happen. So over years, services go down. Now imagine that you change that to a point where you can actually make money out of doing it. And that should make it much more interesting for both governments and private operators to do that. And that's the kind of thing we hope to move to with our investments.
Well, I know you've just recently returned from India. So in the few seconds we have left, can you tell us about the importance of, when you're speaking about governments, that the importance of the Indian government taking on the sanitation as a project and what you learned there?
Well, it was absolutely amazing in that the Modi government has said out of its three priorities in the government, which is getting bank accounts to everybody, improving investment in the country, the third one is sanitation. And so Bill and Melinda were both in India as well. And Bill is always saying, it's like, you know, I'm used to telling ministers that sanitation is important. And the extraordinary thing was that all the ministers were telling him how important sanitation was and how much they wanted to work on that. So that was a fantastic change and one we look forward to working on together with the Modi government.
Well, I imagine that kind of support is really critical in order to get these things done when you talk about the demand side, both top and bottom, from the top and bottom. So the work you're doing, very interesting. Jan Willem, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jan Willem Rosenboom, a senior program officer for water, sanitation, and hygiene at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He served as a juror for the University of Oklahoma's International Water Prize in 2014, and you can watch a recent panel discussion with him and his fellow jurors on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as a collaborative project with OU's College of International Studies. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift. Our producer and digital editor is Brian Hardzinski. And we'd like to welcome our intern for this semester, Sam Dupre. For Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.